other issues that we will have to address if indeed SLED are the reason why, for the behind the hierarchies that we worry about so much today. So the idea that brains and extra dimensions may be able to help with the vacuum energy problem has been around for a long time and is really quite beautiful. The point is that with brains and extra dimensions, gravity, they can change the way that gravity responds to the vacuum energy. So a vacuum energy on brain worlds can curve the extra dimensions rather than their intrinsic four-dimensional spacetime. So for example, a three brain in six dimensions has a gravitational back reaction, such as to induce a conical defect in the transverse dimensions, where the deficit angle in the cone is equal to the tension of the brain. So the reason why I'm going to discuss three brains in six dimensions is because of this enticing numerical coincidence between the fundamental scales. So the observed scale of the dark energy turns out to be related to the electron weak scale and the Planck scale in this way. And we already know from Arkani, Hamid, Diwali, and Demopoulos that the Planck scale can be, we can understand why the Planck scale is so large compared to the weak scale if our universe is a brain living in large extra dimensions, submillimeter sized extra dimensions. And this idea becomes even more interesting when we consider it, the relationship between the electroweak and Planck scales and the cosmological constant scale, because it means that we are changing gravity precisely at the scale of the cosmological constant. So large extra dimensions is one ingredient, and the other, of course, is supersymmetry. And here also, brain worlds will be playing a crucial role. So the picture is the following. We live on a brain in supersymmetric large extra dimensions. We know that supersymmetry on the brain has to be broken at scales at least as large as the electroweak scale. On the other hand, because the brain is only gravitationally coupled to the bulk, the supersymmetry breaking scale in the bulk can be gravitationally suppressed. So there's a trickle-down supersymmetry breaking into the bulk, which is gravitationally suppressed and turns out to be exactly the same scale as the cosmological constant in the context of supersymmetric large extra dimensions. Okay, so the picture is the following. Supersymmetry is badly broken on the brain, and this leads to a large tension on the brain aboard of the electroweak scale. But this is a localized vacuum energy which is absorbed by the bulk curvature. Meanwhile, the bulk supersymmetry breaking scale is gravitationally suppressed. And so if the bulk contribution to the vacuum energy is of order of the bulk supersymmetry breaking scale, then we're there. And we may be able to explain not only why the cosmological constant is zero, but why it is so small compared to the Planck scale. Okay, so the outline of my talk. Most of the attempts to explicitly realize this proposal have been made in the context of six-dimensional supergravity. So I will describe to you this theory and how SLED works within that context. I'll then describe to you explicit solutions in which we would like to find this self-tuning behavior that I've described. I'll then describe the stability of these explicit solutions, which is the first question which we need to address. And then I will, so this is work which we hope to put out in the next few days. If you have any comments, they will be much loved. I will talk about the open questions, which are there in the proposal, the predictions that SLED makes and conclude. Okay. So the setting for my discussion will be six-dimensional gauge supergravity. And the fields are the following. There's gravity, there's a bulk dilaton, there are a number of hyperscalars, there's a three-form Kalman field strip, there's a large a number of non-abelian gauge fields, and all their supercars. So points to note about this theory is first that there is a gauge asymmetry, and in this case it leads to a positive definite scalar potential. And secondly, The fermions are chiral, and this means that in general the theory is anomalous. So this can be turned into a virtue, because for special gauge groups and the Hyperino representations, the anomalies can cancel via Green-Schwarz mechanism. So this makes the theory a lot less arbitrary. A lot of work has gone into recently into classifying all the kinds of anomaly-free theories that are possible, and here I summarize for you all the models that have been found to date. There are three rather miraculous ones which contain very non-trivial gauge groups and Hyperino representations. It then becomes easier to satisfy the anomaly conditions if you have the smaller gauge groups, the less U2s and U1s, and it becomes much, much more easier to satisfy the anomaly cancellation if the model has a large number of so-called drone U1s, which are U1s which don't interact with any of the matter. Okay, so that's the bulk. Now let me introduce to the into the system of the brain. So in general, the brain can have a coupling to the bulk mode. In particular, it may have a dilaton coupling, which I will, however, take to zero. In this case, when I solve the equations of motion in the presence of this source brain, the only effect that the brain will have is to induce a delta function singularity in the Ricci scalar of the internal manifold. So, in other words, it's inducing a conical defect in the internal manifold. So what does all this mean for the vacuum energy problem? Well, classically, I can describe the 4D effective vacuum energy by integrating out the field from the action using the equations of motion. So now, because of the relationship between the tension and the bulk curvature that the Einstein equation imposes, it turns out that the contribution to the 4D effective vacuum energy from the brain is exactly cancelled by the contribution from the bulk curvature. Meanwhile, it turns out also that the contribution from all the other bulk fields also turn out to be zero, and so I'm left with the classical 4D effective vacuum energy, which is zero. Notice that the cancellations don't depend at all on the details of the solution, nor on the tensions in particular. I'm not asking that different tensions cancel against each other. It's rather that the bulk will automatically adjust to compensate for the contribution to the vacuum energy from the brain. So what these so-called self-tuning mechanism does depend on is a classical scaling symmetry, which the 6D supergravity has. And therefore, it also depends on the choice for the brain bulk couplings. In particular, I have to choose the coupling of the brain to the bulk in such a way as to preserve this classical scaling symmetry. So this is going to be the main focus of my talk, but let me also mention reiterate that the quantum corrections in the bulk will give me the non-trivial contribution to the dark energy which we observed today. So quantum contributions are going to break this classical scaling symmetry, but the point is that they can be suppressed down to the supersymmetry breaking scale in the bulk, which is of order the dark energy scale today, observed today. Cliff Burgess and Dar Kulver and others have calculated contributions to the bulk groups in some explicit scenarios and found a quintessence type potential of the Albrecht Gordis variety, which to date is phenomenologically viable. So now let me talk about the explicit solutions. So Giddings, Govan and Polk, from now on GDP, found the general solution to the 6D supergravity under the following assumptions: with maximal symmetry in four dimensions, axial symmetry in two dimensions, and at most conical defects. It turns out that the general solution has 4D flat space-time slices, warping, and a compact internal manifold. The dilaton is non-trivial, and I have also a non-trivial background for one of the gauge fields. So the solution turns out to have at most two conical defects, which I will interpret as being sourced by brains. The deficit angles and therefore the tensions of the brains are integration constants. And so at this level, they're arbitrary. And they're independent at this level. So, of course, the deficit angles cannot be greater than 2 pi. On the other hand, it turns out that they can be arbitrarily negative. And so I just wanted to emphasize that at least geometrically speaking, negative deficit angles are perfectly well defined. So just as I can make a cone from a flat disk by splicing out a wedge and gluing together the edges, I can make a cone with a negative deficit angle by starting with a flat disk and splicing in a wedge. And what I end up with is something that looks like a saddle, albeit a rather uncomfortable one. And I just, for fun, wanted to point out that such geometries also feature, you can find them in condensed matter physics, where they appear as nanoprints with negative designation angles. So just to give you a little bit more intuition about the geometry of the solution, it has two interesting limits. One is when we take omega and omega bar, and the parameters is describing the tensions of the brain. When I take the tensions of the brain to be equal, the warped factor goes to 1, and then I end up with the unwarped rugby ball model. Moreover, I can continuously take the tensions of the brain to be 0, and then I go to the classic sphere monocle compactification, which was done by Sullivan and Siskind back in 1984. So, that's not quite the end of the story. Because I have a monocle background, I also have a Dirac quantization condition. It turns out to take this form. EI are the charges of the field under the monocle background. Omega and omega bar, the tensions of the brain. G1 is the U1R gauge coupling. And G background is the gauge coupling of the gauge group in which the monocle lies. And so this condition, a topological condition, relates the tensions and the brain coupling via topological constant. And it raises some interesting issues. One, for monocle embeddings in the U1R, so that the G background is to G1, at least one of the brains, it turns out, must be negative. Secondly, it raises the question, can we describe arbitrary brain tensions with a conical GGP solution? So, in particular, suppose I start off with a configuration of brains which satisfies this condition. Something happens on the brain, the phase transition to change its tension. We have to ask what happens. The hope that there's a desirable answer to this question I think we can have it because this is a topological constraint. And therefore should be stable under denormalization. Moreover, I think it's worth remembering that this can be an issue perhaps relevant only in this particular attempt to embed the SWED proposal in an explicit model. Let me leave this issue behind for a moment and go on to study the stability of the solutions, because if they're not stable, then there's nothing more to say. So here I have all the scalar fluctuations, have the brain bending modes. I have the scalar fluctuations coming from the matter output, which are necessary for anomaly cancellation. So I have a large number of hyperscalar fluctuations and scalars coming from gauge fields, from, in general, non-abelian gauge groups, and I have all the rest. So first of all, let me project out the brain bending modes with an orbit folding for now. Then all the rest was studied by Cliff and others, and they found marginal stability. And so let me now concentrate on this sector. So this sector turns out to be very relevant, because we even know from the classic sphere monopole compactification that embedding the monopole in the Yang-Mills sector generically leads to instabilities. So let me show you how it works here. Oops, that one. So let me consider the scalar fluctuations of gauge fields orthogonal to the monopole background. If I solve their linearized equations of motion before my Kreutzer Klein expansion, I can derive exactly and completely the mass spectrum for the fluctuations. It turns out to take this form. Details aren't necessary. I guess I should just point out that the mass spectrum, of course, depends on the tensions of the brain and also on this monopole number, which appeared in the Dirac quantization convention. Okay. So now that we have the exact and complete Kreutzer Klein mass spectrum, we can address the stability by asking under what conditions the mass squared is greater than zero. So when can we avoid tachyonic masses? So it turns out that we have stability if the monopole number is less than or equal to 1. And let me remind you that the monopole number is basically related to the charges of the fields under the monopole background. So this is a constraint on the charges of the fields, and therefore on the gauge group in which we're embedding the monopole. Okay, this actually turns out to be the same condition as is found in the sphere case, and so the warping and the brain defects do not introduce new instabilities. Moreover, in the model with positive tension brains only, it turns out that we have stability if and only if the monopole number is less than or equal to 1. So, as I said, this is constraining where we can embed the monopole. If we embed the monopole in an abelian factor, then the compactification is stable. If we embed the monopole in a non-abelian factor, then it is generically unstable. So let me consider stable models with just positive tension brains. For example, if we consider the anomaly-free models, which I presented to you earlier, and if I remind you that for positive tension brains, the Dirac quantization condition forbids the embedding in the U1R, then the only stable models turn out to be the E7 times E6 times U1R model with monopole lying in E6. There's one of the models with SU2 times U1R with a particular hyperhelar representation, and then any of the joint U1 models will be stable.
So for the non-abelian case, which are the modes that are unstable for the monopole, like the gauge one?
Yeah, exactly. So the motor, the scalars coming from gauge fields, okay, that are charged from the monopole. Okay, so let me just note something curious, that if the monopole is in a draining one, then there appears to be no reason to impose a Dirac quantization condition because there are no charged fields around. So we can ask the question if this is a simple explicit realization of self-tuning, because in this case, the tensions are arbitrary and there's not even any topological relationship between them. So I can start with a GGP solution with two arbitrary tensions, T bar and T. I can imagine a phase transition happening when they spring T, and the tension will change to T prime. The bulk will just adjust itself, the internal dimensions will curve a bit more, warp a bit more or less, and I will just go into a different GGP solution with, however, still a flat 4D geometry. Okay, how much time do I have?
3 minutes.
So let me just also mention some other interesting things. So the fact that we have derived exactly and completely the Kreutzer Klein spectrum means that we can derive some surprising results. In particular, it turns out that negative tension can actually relax the stability constraint. So it turns out, for example, if I just look at under what conditions the mass squared is greater than zero rather than tachyonic or normally stable, it turns out that if I begin, for example, with a model with n is equal to 2, which would be unstable in the sphere case, then a rugby ball with deficit angle less than minus pi can actually stabilize this instability. So the tachyonic masses get lifted with the aid of these of the negative deficit factor. Okay, let me skip back a second. So let me now discuss the open questions, which are most important to address if we want to use them to explain the cosmological constant problem on dark energy. The first is that, of course, these GGP solutions are not the only solutions to the 6D theory. In fact, if we limit ourselves to just conical defects, the only static solution is 4D flat, but there are, of course, also time-dependent solutions. So Andrew Tolley and others have found some explicit time-dependent solutions. So the question becomes the following. First, are there flat solutions for arbitrary brain tensions? So I would like the answer to be yes, but even if not, we can ask the question, can we set up the initial conditions in such a way that that there is a flat solution? And this leads me to the second part. So that was the open questions in within the classical dynamics. This leads me into the open questions within the quantum dynamics, which is, are the choices required for the 4D flat cosmologies stable against renormalization? So if we need to fine-tune the initial condition or set up the initial conditions in such a way, in order to obtain flat 4D solutions, are these choices stable against renormalization? And the fact that the limitation appears to be in topological constraints seems suggestive that maybe this is true. The other choices that are required, for example, was that the brain wasn't coupled to the dilaton in order to preserve the classical scaling symmetry. So is this are these kinds of choices stable against renormalization? And the second question in terms of the quantum dynamics is, do the bulk contributions to the vacuum energy really cancel down to the supersymmetry bulk breaking scale to the 4, or are there also higher order contributions, for example, the supersymmetry breaking scale to the 2? So these questions need to be addressed. Okay. So one of the reasons why it certainly seems worth thinking about these issues is that SLED is really very, very predictive. It's making predictions at the bounds of experiments, not only in cosmology, but also in gravity, in astrophysics, and accelerators. For example, it predicts deviations from inverse square law for gravity at submillimeter scales, which should be coming up soon, a particular scalar tensor theory of gravity at large distances, potential astrophysical signals and bounds due to energy loss in extra dimension by stars and supernovae, and distinctive missing energy signals at the LHC due to emission of particles into the extra dimensions. Okay, so let me conclude. Supersymmetric large extra dimensions may provide a technically matching solution to the cosmological constant problem. The new physics that's playing important roles is that we change gravity at the scale of the cosmological constant, and that supersymmetry is helping in a non-conventional way. We can have supersymmetry badly broken in our universe. What's important is that it's not badly broken in the bulk. 6D supergravity provides us with a laboratory in which to explore these ideas and co-dimension two phase in general. The self-tuning solutions seem to be stable only in a few special models, though not we can turn this into a virtue, and basically it's again making the models, even just like the anomic cancellation conditions, much less arbitrary. Also, there's this curious aspect of that, embedding the monopole in the Joinery 1s, where it seems we might be able to avoid the direct quantization condition and therefore have simple realizations of self-tuning. The explicit calculations reveal some surprising dynamics for six-dimensional, pro-dimension 2 brain worlds. There are negative tension brain can actually relax stability constraints. And I didn't have time to show you, but it turns out that conical defects can allow a large mass gap for large volume compactifications. There remain several open questions, but I think it's worth thinking about them, especially taking into consideration there are many and diverse predictions within the reach of the panel experiments. Thank you for your attention.
One of the problems, of this self-tuning idea, this is a standard problem, that this can work as long as you have an exactly passless modulus. But then the question why this modulus is not getting a large mass, is exactly equivalent to the cosmological constant problem. And until somebody resolves that, that's...
Yeah. So I'm glad you asked that question because I felt like I wasn't explaining it very well. I didn't really address it. So, so it's true. So the classical scaling symmetry that's guaranteeing the self-tuning mechanism is also giving rise to a massless mode. And of course this massless mode, we can interpret this massless mode to be the size of the extra dimension. So this... it does indeed acquire a mass because this scaling symmetry is only a classical one, so we expect quantum corrections to break it. And then the point is that because the supersymmetry is protecting us from these quantum corrections down to the supersymmetry breaking scale, we can expect that the mass acquired by this massless mode from the quantum correction is hierarchically small. So this is this sort of, I haven't worked on this, but this was a potential...
Not small enough, right? Okay. That's wrong. Because supersymmetry has to be broken at the TV scale. I'm not inventing anything.
No, but supersymmetry is broken on at the TV scale, on the brain, but it's above.
Yeah, that doesn't matter. This radius modulus, look from the point of view of effective four-dimensional theory. This radius modulus is a gravitationally coupled field, and so the mass that's generated will be supersymmetry breaking scale divided by Planck square, the usual story. Maybe there will be a one loop factor there. But that mass is already huge. So
you're asking about this contribution to the mass.
I don't know. If
which is like which is the supersymmetry suppressed by the supersymmetry breaking scale.
He's got even bigger one than that.
Probably that one. Yeah. It looks like that one. Yeah.
I think that's right, and that's exactly the question maybe we're trying to answer. So the first step of it is that once you're up to the four-dimensional, the Gibbs time scale depends the size of time scale. You've got general covariance dimension that restricts the kinds of counterterms you can get. So then the question becomes, in the modes between the Gibbs time scale and the Leak scale, what are the size? What's the ultraviolet time scale? Be the answer. Mm-hmm. And you win a little bit because the bulk is no one's all over. Once you're at the Leak scale, the bulk is all over the six-dimensional supersymmetry. Yeah. And you win a little bit because for the brains, the condition for the thought solutions is that the dilaton doesn't couple to the brain, so you don't generate dilaton coupling when you do both of those, but it's a mixed dose between the two of them.
I agree with it, but
those are dangerous ones.
Yeah.
So
but you win really a little bit.
Yeah, well, so the question is, if it comes down to that C2 has to be zero. And so far...
C2 cannot be zero, it has no reason to, maybe by some miracle it comes out to be one loop, but...
So what happens is that there are a lot of contributions from the bulk alone are zero on C2.
Absolutely.
The brain alone, and the mixed ones, we don't know yet. The most
dangerous contribution comes from the fact that you are effectively, the way you can think of it, it's like this. If you wish, you can think of it as some kind of a contribution coming from the Hausdorff-Klein loops, but each of them has a supersymmetry breaking scale, which is small. Right. But you have to sum up of the whole tower. And then it comes up to something like C2 of order. It's a one-loop suppression there, but it's not like a Mendel suppression.
If you never touch the brains, then you're like, those are actually good because
but you touch brains through the. You see what happens to it? Your brain supersymmetry on the grain. So there is a spurium on which gives a matrix, which induces a mass splitting in each Kallister plane state.
That's the one we're working on.
Exactly. But then you have some summed them up. And once you sum them up, the effect becomes that the C2 is order one, well, after one loop up.
Well, the summing is actually misleading, because if you make the same
sum. Well, we have done that explicitly. I don't know.
I don't think in a certain situation.
Yeah, probably on this one. Yeah, I'm going to actually not to understand myself. Yeah, exactly. And that's, we exactly computed mass of the modules to be like. I mean, we didn't look for the cosmological quantum problem. It's a completely different thing. But the calculation is the same.
Yeah, and I think the calculation has mine.
Right.
So if you do it as a four dimensional calculation and summing the loose line loans, you can get misled as to how big the answer is. And so and that's because you're losing all the symmetries that are in the four dimensional, the six dimensional.
I completely agree with that, but I think that, anyway, that's one loop calculation. Now, then, of course, you have to be sure that there are two loops, because now brain fields, they fit two loops. All I'm saying is that this is a central question.
That's exactly right, question. Yeah. Two loops and higher, where you win there is that every loop in the ball brings in an extra factor of the dilaton. And the thing is that the classical solution relates to the dilaton e to the phi is 1 over r squared. So additional powers of e to the dilaton are giving additionally small terms of that series in 1 over r squared. So that if you were to do a two-loop correction to the first term, that actually is the same size as the second term, which is actually the size you want. So the dangerous ones are lower as the loops, minimal number of loops, which takes a grain and couples of two of. And so those are the ones. The whole point I'm getting is explicit solutions to try and really nail that.
Yeah, I completely agree that the ones that I know I have computed are the ones that you're talking about, the with the mixed ones. And there, in that particular computation, the C2 came out for the one.
And that was in parallel gate C2?
That was in, we had a horrible computation. Because computation, I don't know, maybe because of specifics of some supergravity, by some reason, the C2 may turn out to be much smaller, but my point is that, you see, we need the C2 to be not just a little bit smaller, it should be tremendously smaller. So that's my worry.
You need C2 to be a order one of our experts.
Exactly, yeah, which is a huge number. Right. I mean, sorry, it's a very small number. Anyway, I'm not saying anything new. I think everybody understands that there is this problem.
Yeah, it's an important question. Yeah. This is pretty good. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It's an instability. So in the non-real case, we've talked about it before. The instability, does that mean that the orientation of the background field is less realigned in the non-human group and then to the greater place?
Yeah, I don't know what the dynamics would be if you were to start with the monopole in a direction which is unstable.
But is there a difference between finite spatial configuration in any non-real group where the thing?
No. So, for example, if I were just to have the monopole if I were to have the sorry, how can I? Let me. I have a slide that will. Okay. So where did it go? Okay, so for example, if I were to start off with a theory, the six-dimensional theory to be E7 times V2 times V1R, then there is no direction in the G7 times in the E7 times G2 times V1R, which is stable. So I can't put the monopole anywhere, especially if I'm restricting myself to positive tension range, which means I can't put it in the U1R. Because if I put it in the U1R, it's stable, because it's abelian, there's nothing charged under it. But if I restrict myself to positive tension grains, it's impossible to have this compact condition in that state. And that's the same also for the F4 times S9 times U1R. So there seems to be something to be about this one.
I wanted just to comment on that. It's a very interesting effect. The way you can think about it is like, the off-diagonal non-abelian, let's call it W, but of these groups, they are condensing in the magnetic field of the monopole. Mm-hmm. So that's the way you can think of this stability.
But that would mean they move somewhere, and you're saying that we don't go.
Yeah, that I don't know.
No stable configuration.
So in this case, then there is a stable configuration.
But supposing you stick it in the group where there isn't one, then where does it go?
So I don't know the answer to that. That's a hard question. All I can say is that, so the instability, for example, is arising from the gauge kinetic term. So Basically, I'm getting a mass term for the. So if I have the gauge connector, VA plus A with A squared, right? So in the cross term, if I take the background value for the flux here, I'm going to get a mass term for these fluctuations. And that's where the instability is from. That's where the tachyonic mass is coming from. So I don't know, the fact that this is the gauge kinetic term, it's positive definite, it seems like maybe the tachyonic instability is going to be stabilized by the quartic terms. But when you go beyond bilinear order, then everything's coupling, and so
that's how the six-dimensional component of the gauge field is turning on and becoming non-zero.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like at least if everything is coming from this gauge kinetic term, it seems like the minimum is going to be when they're zero. But that might not be true on bilinear order. So.
Thank you.